Support for Art Talks comes from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com. And from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from Red Band Coffee Company, local roaster, offering individually prepared coffees, New Orleans-style iced coffee, and whole bean coffee at two locations in Davenport. Information is at redbandcoffee.com.
Well, hello and welcome. You've tuned into a conversation between artists. For the next hour, we'll be exploring the mind and the creativity of our guest. This is Art Talks, and I'm your host, Bruce Carter. Well, hello again and welcome. Our guest today is the internationally known woodturner and sculptor from Galway, Ireland, named Liam O'Neill, L-I-A-M O'Neill. He's been here a month now visiting to create a large turned wooden chair, which he's been making in front of the Figge Art Museum, right up by the front door. Perhaps you saw it during the Beaux Arts Festival, and he's calling it the Throne. Marvelous piece. The piece was finished and set up inside the Figge for the official unveiling on September 14th, 2014, in the main entrance, and its final destination will be in the River Center. It'll be a marvelous piece. You can get your picture taken in it. You're just surrounded by wood. And with us to tell his interesting story is Liam O'Neill. And Liam, what a pleasure to have you on the show, and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
It is. I heard that you were coming to town. I think the woodcarvers from the area had something to do with it, Steve Sinner, and brought you up to talk to Tim. And from there, you began your operation. And I remember I had a class on Thursday, and I was going in, and I saw you pouring concrete in this enormous structure as big as a little car. And I thought, what is he doing with that? And then next day I came by and you had a lathe attached to it and you had this big hunk of wood and now you're carving it. Fascinating thing that you're doing. It's like it's so huge. But tell us your story. How did you get to this point? Where did you get into wood? How did it work for you?
Well, I need to tell you a little about my background, my upbringing. I was brought up on a small farm in Ireland, about 20 acres, mixed farming. All the farms around us were small, and it was a very kind of rural area. And people were very self-sufficient. And when somebody wanted a new door for their house, they called on the local carpenter, who came with a bicycle and a few planks strapped to the bicycle and tools. And I'll never forget being about 5 years of age and for the very first time seeing a carpenter planing a board just outside our front door, making a door for our house. And it was just fascinating to me, the sharpness of the edge, the singing of the plane, the curly shavings. Something resonated with me, you know. But I never had any opportunity to do any woodwork. I just went to school. School was very rural, a mountain area. I started going to school in 1955 at 6 years of age. So you know I was born in 1949 now. But anyway, the school was interesting in the fact that it had no electricity or water. It had no light of any kind. It was just pure daylight, an outside toilet, or the nearest stone wall, whichever. But anyway, that was my upbringing. It was very rural. I grew up in a thatched farmhouse, very old house, about, we believe, from about the 1700s, sometime in the 1700s, older than America. So very old house. and grew up there. And as I say, after school, I kind of didn't like school, I have to say. I left school at 14, just flunked out. Couldn't take school at all. So after a period of time during my teens in which I was a bartender, a grocer's assistant, I did a bit of steel erecting, did a bit of farm work, and I got into music. So I used to play folk music. Everybody in Ireland had a folk group in the 60s, just like over here. But after going through my teens, kind of just drifting from one job to another, I felt very rudderless. And eventually I heard that there was a man starting a woodwork business in the local town, which was 7 miles away. So I got on my bicycle and I went in and I did an interview for this man. And lo and behold, he took me on. Now, at this stage, I was 19. I had, as I say, left school at 14, but I had always continued to read. So I was a reader, a self-educator, if you like. Never stopped reading. But I knew that this man was doing some kind of woodwork, but I didn't know what kind. I thought he'd be making tables and chairs, this kind of thing. So having got the job, walked into work the first Monday morning, and there was a man turning a lamp on a lathe. And I had never seen wood turning done before. I had no idea how round objects were made, wooden objects, how they were made. Never saw a wood turning lathe in my life. I was fascinated by the fact that he had taken a square block of wood about 6 inches square and about a foot long. He put it on the lathe, put it spinning, and then took up a sharp tool called a gouge and started to shape this piece. And the shavings were flying, and, you know, the best way to describe wood turning is applying a sharp tool to a piece of spinning wood so that you are continuously removing wood. It's a subtractive process. You take away what you don't want and end up with whatever you hope to achieve. And this happened to be a lamp that this man was making, a lamp base. And I was so fascinated by this, I never wanted to do anything ever again. I never wanted to do anything else ever again. I tried other forms of woodwork subsequently, but I always went back to the wood turning.
Why did he hire you?
He said at the time that he didn't want a kid out of school. He wanted somebody a little bit more mature. And I suppose because I came across as somebody who maybe had a bit of intelligence, I don't know, eagerness, wanting to learn. I really don't know why the man picked me. But we're still great friends to this day anyway. I'll be eternally grateful to him. But I've always been fascinated by the fact that I ended up doing something which I love without ever knowing what it was. I mean, people continuously ask me, you know, did your grandfather do this? Did your father do this? Did your uncle do this? Or did you see it in shop in school and want to do it? But the answer is I never knew what it was. And I say this all the time. I think God just reached down his hand, took me by the scruff of the neck and lifted me into this woodworking, wood turning shop and said, you're going to be a wood turner. And I've often wondered, you know, about God's purposes in doing things. But as subsequent events proved, he had a reason. And it's been an interesting journey.
So then what happened?
Well, it at that time in the 60s, Ireland was independent for 40 years at that stage. And for the first 30 years of independence, Ireland as a country was very insular. And because we had been under the yoke of the British for so long, and because they were our next door neighbour, we were very kind of stuck into our own culture. And it was a mistake, really, because we were still into shamrocks and shillelaghs and harps and, you know, very, very kitschy, crafty stuff. And the Irish government at that time was led by a prime minister called Sean Lemass, who was amazing. He opened up the country in an amazing way. But he looked at the craft set and design sector, and he said that it needed a huge kick in the rear. So he founded a national design centre called Kilkenny Design Workshops, and he brought in designers from Scandinavia, from Europe, from Britain, and they would come in and they would do two things. One, they would provide designs that were then used in industry, small industry, pottery, weaving, furniture making, all anything to do with the home crafts. And at the same time, they were training Irish designers who would take over when they left. So at that time also, you had a lot of people setting up craft workshops and hiring small numbers of people. And so the whole country was moving out of this kind of shamrocks and shillelaghs, paddy whackery kind of thing, and becoming more like into modern design. The situation in Ireland now is that it's a very modern and country with a lot of very good design coming out, and some very well known international craftspeople in not just wood turning but silver and jewellery, pretty much all disciplines. Ireland is doing well internationally.
You came along at the perfect time.
Absolutely. It was interesting that Kilkenny Design Workshops, the guy who trained me had worked there making prototypes in their workshop and decided to set up his own business. So when he had me working for him, I got this wonderful training, because the designers in Kilkenny would come up with a prototype for a product. They would send it out to our workshop. I would get a blueprint and be told, make that. And I had to learn very quickly. Now, remember, my schooling was minimal, but I had to learn how to read a blueprint and how to convert that into a three-dimensional object.
Learning your craft.
Learning my craft the hard way. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful training.
How many years was that?
I was with him for 4 years.
You were an apprentice for four years?
Yeah, you would call it an apprentice. Now, there is an official apprenticeship system in Ireland for most crafts, but for wood turning, there isn't, because it's such a small number of practitioners. But in effect, it was the equivalent of an apprenticeship.
Hmm. Fascinating. We're speaking with Liam O'Neill. You can follow along www.liamoneill.com. Nice website for his work. So how did you go for being a wood turner? Obviously, you make bowls, you make lamps, you make tall things, you make faces. How did you get into something like chairs? What was the development there?
Okay, well, it takes a bit of time. I was only ever aware of wood turning in my first 12 years as a wood turner. Wood turning to me was a utilitarian process that you made useful pieces. And then in 1980, I found out that there was going to be a symposium on wood turning in the UK. And they were going to have international turners from different countries, Australia, England, and the US and Canada. And I was fascinated by the idea that a gathering of international people could have a big discussion about wood turning, which to me, I thought I knew all about. So I went, and what I saw blew my mind, because I did not know that you could take a very colourful piece of wood and make an art object, a studio object that was not for utilitarian use, but purely for its artistic merit, just to sit there and be beautiful. I did not know that. And it turns out that at that time, in the 70s and 80s, the US was producing the world's first studio woodturners, basically. You had people like David Ellsworth, Bob Stocksdale, people like this, who were really pushing the boundaries of wood turning, creating out of very colourful wood beautiful objects which were just poetry in motion, you know. They were just beautiful to look at. They would use the grain of the wood and match it to a shape. Bob Stocksdale made a lot of very open bowls, very thin walls. He was married to, he's passed on now, but he was married to a Japanese woman, so he had that influence, the tea bowl shape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
David Ellsworth was doing something completely different. He was taking beautiful pieces of wood, making round, almost ball-like pieces, and then through a small hole, maybe only 3/4 of an inch in diameter in the top, he would extract the hole inside, and they would be almost eggshell thin.
How could he do that?
Oh, it's fascinating to watch. He invented his own kind of tools.
Mm.
And it's now done by a lot of people, but he was the first. He was a real pioneer. He's still going strong, still one of my best friends. Has been a huge influence on me and on my work. But those kind of people, when I walked into that symposium in Parnham House in Dorset in England, I must say, like, I was totally overwhelmed by what I saw. And I was so overwhelmed that on my way home, I remember the first couple of nights when I was sleeping in a hotel room or whatever, I would be seeing shapes dancing in my head. You know, it was like just, you know, my dreams. I was half awake and half asleep and seeing all these shapes. It had totally gone into my brain.
Boom, boy. And you went from useful to useless objects?
Exactly. Except that we now know that they're not useless. You know, like Picasso said, art blows the dust off the mind of everyday life or whatever. You know, it's like our creativity, making beautiful things and admiring them. Well, I'm a believer in God. I believe God is the supreme creator, and I believe we're made in his image. So when we create, I look on it as a form of worship of the creator. You're actually doing what he would do. So you're kind of following on from what God intended us to be creative.
Hmm.
The human being is very creative. Whether it's, you know, even if it's something as mundane as being an inventor of any kind, that's all. To me, that's all being made in the image of God. So I see it all as part of a whole symbiotic relationship with design and people thinking and coming up with new ideas and being influenced. And it's interesting, influences cross from one discipline to another all the time, and we learn from all kinds of sources. But when I went home from that symposium, I started my own studio on a part-time basis. And I made some of these art objects, which people can see on my website now. They can see some of my art objects. But I took them to a local gallery in, at the time I was living near Limerick City. And the gallery I took them to was a very conservative gallery. Very, very conservative. But the man who owned it happened to be a hobby woodturner. And when he saw my pieces, he had the same reaction that I had had at the symposium. He was fascinated, you know. So he put them in his gallery, and lo and behold, they sold. And I was delighted because I was getting almost the same amount of money for one of my pieces as I would be getting for a whole week's work in my workshop, you know.
Sweet. Well, Liam O'Neill is with us. You can follow along, L-I-A-M O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L.com. Marvelous stuff. And he's here working at the Figge. He's been here for about a month, his wooden chair. Let's take a short break right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Augustana College Art Museum through October 25th, A Different Way of Seeing, Swedish art from the Charters Collection. Hours are noon to 4, Tuesday through Saturday. In the Art Space Gallery in Building 4 on the Blackhawk College campus in Moline through September 19th, paintings by David Murray. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. In the Galvin Fine Arts Center on the St. Ambrose University campus in Davenport in the Morrissey Gallery, through September 28th. Mixed Media Works by Heather Baker. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. In the Kanich Gallery through October 24th, Bookworks by Brian Borkert and Quilts by Eric Wolfmeyer. Hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. At the Figge Art Museum on West 2nd Street in Davenport through October 26th, Living Proof, works by cancer survivors and patients. Through November 2nd, two Americans in Paris, Stuart Davis and Grant Wood. Through January 25th, Turned Wood. And through April 30th, A Legacy for Iowa. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursday. At Midcoast at Center Station on River Drive in Moline through September 30th, drawings by Ann Kaufman and Mixed Media Works by Isaias Mejia. Hours are 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, 9 to 5 Sunday. At Midcoast Gallery West on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through the end of October, acrylics by Dan Johnson and jewelry by Monica Shans. Hours are 11:30 to 5:30 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Bucktown Center for the Arts on East 2nd Street in Davenport through the end of October, photography by Richard Kluel and Matthew Terry. Hours are Wednesday through Saturday from 11 to 6. At the Quonset Arts Gallery on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through October 24th, Good Enough to Eat, an art buffet. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 11 to 5. At Quad City Arts at the airport in the Moline International Airport through October 30th, Mixed Media Works by Kimberly Roca, collages by Amber Williams, and stoneware by Dale DeBokey. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
Back on Art Talks, Liam O'Neill, LiamOneill.com, is here with us. He's an internationally known Irish wood turner and sculptor who's been working at the Figge for the last month, making this marvelous big wood turned lathe, but not a lathe, it's a chainsaw on it. But let's continue on your story. Liam, you were taking these wood-turned balls after being blown out of the water by this wood-turner's congress in England, and you saw pieces that were very different than what you had been making, and you came back and you made some of your own and you took it to a gallery, and lo and behold, they sold. And was that a surprise for you, or did you think that maybe this was going to be useless stuff that would be sitting on the shelf?
To be honest, I brought the pieces into the gallery with some hope that they would be well received, because I felt that, you know, most people were like me. If they were presented with something that was beautiful and new, and that they would maybe be interested in it. So, you know, it proved to be true. But when I set up my own studio at that stage, I had been, by the way, working, training psychiatric people for 11 and a half years. That's what I did from the time I finished my apprenticeship until I set up my studio. So I was training psychiatric people. Now, we weren't training woodturners. We were just training human beings. We were, you know, it was rehabilitation, if you like. So I continued doing that in tandem with doing my studio work for a period of 3 or 4 years. Hmm. Now, I got the idea at that time of holding a similar symposium in Ireland to the one I've seen in England. So I went to the boss of the facility where I worked and I talked to him, and he was very much in favour. And his words were, well, providing we make a profit, you can do it. So what we did was we brought in some international turners from the UK, and we set it up over a weekend, putting our wood turning lathes in different rooms in this factory space. And we managed to get 70 or 80 people to come from around Ireland, and they had never been to a symposium or workshop of a, of that type ever. There'd never been one in Ireland. So it was a great success. And I kept all the names and addresses. And then the following year, in the spring, I invited them back to where I was working. And we formed the Irish Woodturners Guild. And the Irish Woodturners Guild was the very first national Woodturners Guild in the world in the modern era. It was the first national association of woodturners, and I deliberately set out to have it as an all-Ireland body. In other words, the Republic of Ireland and Ulster, you know, the north of Ireland. I just decided that it should be an all-Ireland body, and it, from the very start, it's always been a cross-community effort, and it worked very well. We started to bring in international woodturners, and the guild began to grow. And one of the people we brought in from this country was the aforementioned David Ellsworth. Now, when he saw what a national guild of woodturners working together could do, he was inspired to come back here to this country, come home to the US. And he called together woodturners from all over the US and brought them to the Aramont School for Arts and Crafts down in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, over a weekend in September, and it was 1985. And it was mooted, the idea of starting an American Association of Woodturners. And he quoted the fact that the Irish had done so well that, you know, if the Irish can do it, well, the US can do it, you know. So, and sure enough, they founded the American Association of Woodturners. And I'm a founder, charter founder member, which is something I'm proud of. I've been a member ever since.
From Ireland, a founder member of the United States.
Now, something happened to me back in the meantime, which brought me to the US as a student of woodturning. And that was that there was a crafts competition in Ireland, in Dublin, which covered all crafts. And I won the woodturning section, and I was nominated for a prize of a development grant, and there were six other nominees, and whoever told the best story got the grant.
And the best yarn or the best?
Well, the best reason for getting, you know, why should we give you this money? And at the time it was £1,000, which was a lot of money. So I pointed out that I had founded the Irish Woodturners Guild and that I was bringing in international turners, and that I intended going to the US and visiting the top studio woodturners in the US and bringing back whatever knowledge I would gain from them and disseminate it out through the guild. And that was the winner.
Nice.
And I ended up coming over here in 1984 and visiting all a lot of the top woodturners in this country. And when I was here, I was asked to demonstrate just one turn, 1 hour and a half session at a symposium out in Utah. And I did such a good job that they asked me back as a demonstrator the following year. And from then on, until the present day, I've been on the demonstrating and teaching circuit right throughout the US.
Wow. What a different kind of life.
Yeah.
You're like a musician traveling around.
Yeah, a bit like that, yeah.
Giving concerts.
But I would only do that on a part-time basis, maybe 3 times a year, come over for 3-4 weeks and do a little bit of a circuit.
What happened to your work in the meantime? Did it change?
It always kept developing. Now, coming over here was great because I kept bumping up against all the best that was going on in the field. And I would teach them and they would teach me. You see, it was a perfect marriage. The reason why I went down so well over here as a teacher was that I had the skill. You know, I had the tool technology.
From your long apprenticeship.
That's right. Whereas over here, they have the ideas. And that's a perfect marriage.
They have the ideas?
The ideas, the best ideas in woodturning have always come from the US.
Why is that? And what did you mean?
Well, when I attended that symposium I was telling you about in 1980, the best studio woodturners there were from the US. So I have always noticed that the best kind of, the ones who pushed the envelope have always been the US turners. They were never happy with just making salad bowls. They had to go and make beautiful, useless objects, you know, which ended up in the Renwick and Museum of Modern Collection, Art in New York, and Metropolitan Museum, and all the rest of it. Any museum, the Figge even has a collection of wood-turned objects.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't put anything in them. They're pretty useless.
Mm. It's my favorite kind of art.
Yeah.
Huh. So your work has gone from being a craft, making bowls. There's a picture of you that you showed at the opening, at the dedication of your piece. And behind you were stacks and stacks and stacks of wooden bowls behind.
That's right.
That was your bread and butter for a long time?
Yeah, it still is, believe it or not. I'm still making salad bowls because you can't, you know, most artists do something besides make art to support themselves. Like, a lot of them teach, you know, give classes and that kind of thing. In my case, I just continued to make salad bowls.
Mm.
And now my salad bowls are fairly upmarket. They would be fairly expensive and mostly one of a kind, but they're still salad bowls.
And pens.
Well, yeah, the pens was a thing that came along. In my business, the answer to all your questions is yes. If somebody comes and says, can you do something, I will say yes. So I was approached by our national airline, Aer Lingus, and they wanted 1,200 pens to give as gifts for some purpose or other, which I can't remember now. So, of course, I said yes. And so I, at that stage, you could buy the pen parts and you cut up your pieces of wood, you know, and drill the holes in them and then assemble them and turn them. And I've made pens and I would again if I got the money.
So tell us about coming here to the Figge. How did that work?
That's a very interesting... Well, as part of my journey around the US teaching workshops, I was here in Rock Island, only a few blocks from where we're sitting, teaching the local woodturners, the Quad City Woodturners, which is a chapter of the American Association of Woodturners. I was here last year with my wife, Kathy, and Steve Sinner, who's a local artist and also very heavily involved with both the Figge and the Quad City Woodturners, invited me to come and meet Tim Schiffer down at the Figge. Tim is the director of the Figge. And as we walked around, Tim mentioned that he had seen my website and that he was impressed with my work, and particularly the outdoor turn pieces, which I do, which we will talk about later, I'm sure, in this talk. But I said to Tim, you know, I said, I make these huge vessels on a concrete lathe, which I cast outside my workshop. And I said, I'd love to do the same over in the US somewhere, a museum, an arts facility, a craft school. Just come, cast a concrete lathe, use it to make an object and leave that object wherever it was made. And then the lathe would be disposed of course, because it's just concrete. And he said, well, let me think about it. And sure enough, he managed to raise the funds, and here I am.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
And then you set yourself up in front of the Figge. I saw the pouring of the concrete. And how long you have it? You had no blueprints. You just did it in your head.
Well, I had made one at home, was making outdoor turnings on it since the mid-90s.
Mm.
So what I did was I just came up with drawings for a casting box, which I sent over to the Figge. The Figge has a man who is in charge of keeping everything running in the Figge, Bob DeBlay. And I sent over the drawings, and when I got here, Bob had prepared all the wood and we put this box together, and we had... a lot of through rods, all thread rods holding this box together, because the pressure of the concrete when it's full of wet concrete, that's pretty, a lot of pressure. So the all threads hold the box together and then act as rebar as well. So we did that. We made the box, Bob and I, and we put it up outside the Figge. And then as you saw, the big concrete truck backed up, and it looked so funny to see concrete being poured right in front of the front door of the Figge. But it worked well.
Mm-hmm.
And then East Moline Sheet Metal, I had sent over drawings of all the metal parts, and they came up with all the metal parts.
Nice.
And they did that there, Mike Dorbeck. They worked extremely hard and did everything we asked them to do.
Terrific. I noticed that the wood turned on its own. There was no motor turning it. You could spin it by hand.
Yeah.
And then you had a, rather than a chisel, you had a long, long chainsaw.
That's correct.
That was attached. And that's how you trim the wood down.
Yeah.
That was incredible. It was like, well, what a, sure, why not use a chainsaw on its edge, just kind of right up against the corn on the cob of the wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I started to make very large objects in the beginning, especially outdoor pieces, I realized very quickly you couldn't use normal wood turning tools. And I had seen turners use a chainsaw to decorate their wood turnings.
Hmm.
Just, you know, the grooving and the shape that the blade of the chainsaw can produce. And I thought, well, why not just use the chainsaw to make the whole piece? And so that's what I started to do. And so the chainsaw is fixed to a T-bar, which is attached to a tool rest on the lathe. And people have visions of me standing there holding this chainsaw in my hands, but that's not what happens. It's firmly fixed, very safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city of Davenport, in the form of the arborist Chris Johnson, they spent a lot of time helping me to find a log that would make this chair. And it was very difficult because we had to find something at least 30 inches, like 30 inches of usable wood after taking off the bark and the cambium layer and all that kind of thing. So we spent a whole day, Bob and Chris and myself, looking at trees all over the city. And we eventually came upon one in Vanderveer Park, and it was right beside Brady Street. Now the branches were dying off on the top, so this tree had to come down because it was becoming dangerous. You know, dying branches could fall off and hit somebody passing by on the footpath. So we felled the tree and discovered that the bottom 6 feet was just right for what we wanted. And so we did that. We got that big log, and I'll never forget, we brought it up to the yard belonging to the city. And one of the things I do with a big log like that is the weight. I like to reduce the weight as much as possible before I fix it on the lathe. So I took a huge plunge cut hole in one end of the log, and it involved plunging. I don't know if you understand, usually when people use a chainsaw, they use the long side. This involves pushing the nose of the chainsaw directly straight into a log and just... And I used a 4 foot bar, plunged it straight into the log, and did this a number of times until I had cut a circle. And then butchered out that 4 foot section out of the log, and it made a big difference to the weight.
Sure, it's not solid all the way through.
It's not solid all the way. You're not dealing with a whole solid, you know. And the other thing is you have to trim in the log so that it's balanced. When it goes up on the lathe, it's fixed on the lathe with a faceplate, which is 16 inches diameter, and which is screwed directly onto the spindle of the lathe. And it's got 24 four-inch, half-inch leg screws holding it in place. And there's no support on the other end. So all the weight is on this. And I reckon that the piece was well over half a ton, even with all the trimming and taking out a core out of one end. So...
Marvellous. Speaking with Liam O'Neill, you can follow along, liamoneill.com, L-I-A-M, O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L. Marvellous stuff, and his piece is in front of the Figgy and is going to be put in the River Centre very shortly. Time for another break. Let's take one now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Geneseo Art League Gallery on South State Street in Geneseo, Wood Art Show, works by Jim Dayton, Bob Benson, Carl Smith, and Warren Hadley. Hours are 11 to 5 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Renee Gray Gallery on South Cody Road in LeClaire through September 28th, A Personal Perspective, Finding Beauty in the Unexpected, works by Lee Kimball and other artists. Hours are 11 to 5 every day except Sunday. at Roz Talks on 3rd Avenue in Rock Island on continuing exhibit, Object Permanence, works by 20 local artists. Hours are 11 to 1 a.m. Tuesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Sunday. At the Galesburg Civic Arts Center at 114 East Main Street in Galesburg, through October 18th, works by Joyce and Jeffrey Gellick. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10:30 to 4:30, Saturday from 10:30 to 3. At the Buchanan Center for the Arts on the Square in Monmouth through October 25th, the Security Savings Bank Photo Competition. Hours are 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, Saturdays from 10 to 2. At the Muscatine Arts Center at 1314 Mulberry Avenue in Muscatine through January 25th, Railroads of Muscatine County. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 5, Thursday evening 7 to 9, Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 5. At the Dubuque Museum of Art at 701 Locust Street in Dubuque through October 19th, Modern Landscapes, paintings by Grant William Tye. Through November 30th, Homage to the Tall Grass Prairie, watercolors by George Olson. The Grant Wood Gallery on continuing exhibit. Hours are Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10 to 5, Thursdays until 7 p.m., Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 4. At the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art at 410 3rd Avenue in Cedar Rapids, through November 2nd, Marvin Cohn, On My Mind, The Ceramics of Dean Schwartz. On continuing exhibit, Art in Roman Life, Grant Wood in Focus, and Maurizio Lozanski, Master Printmaker. Hours are Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 4, Thursdays 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sundays noon to 4. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
Back on our talks, Liam O'Neill is with us, the fabulous wood turner and sculptor whose work was made outside of the front door of the Figgy and is now stationed in the River Center up by the big window. This program and many, many previous programs going back about 2 years are available at our website, wvik.org. Click on the schedule button at the top of the page and scroll down to Art Talks, and they will appear by date, the name of the artist, and a brief description of what they do. Liam, we last left off when you had bolted this half-ton piece of wood, which you had bored out the center with a chainsaw and cut it almost like a Viking making a ship. Mm-hmm. And then you attached it to this concrete lathe, turning it on its own and cutting it with the chainsaw. And then comes the time where you have to cut the opening of the chair out for you. First of all, why a chair? Why not just a bowl? But where did the idea for a chair come from? Is that from your Irish history too?
Well, what happened there was I have always had the ability to listen to people. And there was a guy came into my workshop in Spittal, and I had made two vessels about 4 foot high, which were sitting in the side of my workshop drying out. And these vessels were for a public art sculpture, and I had cut open the one side so that they were curved shapes. And his friend was walking by, and he looked at these things sitting there, and he sat into one, and he said, "Oh, look, chairs." And then it was like a light bulb over my head. Yeah. So I started making, deliberately making chairs. Now, what appealed to me, and I've done some, two sets of five for, I've been commissioned twice now to do sets of five for parks in Ireland. The idea is that it's sculpture, but it's people can sit in it. They can be enfolded. They can be almost like in the womb. You know, there's a private space. It's like... And then the wood is so tactile and so warm. it's a lovely experience.
And you're inside of a tree.
You're inside a tree, yeah.
It's mythic and ancient and new and fun and sculpture and practical in a sense that you can sit in it too. Very nice. And that was your conception of it.
That's how I conceived the idea of the tree. So the one in the figgy, it was turned first like a big vase. I don't know how you say it over here. But so it looks like a very, very deep cup, basically. But then when you cut it open, you cut out one side, you cut the shape so that people can sit into it. And then you shape the back. Sometimes I make them with a wide opening and sometimes a fairly narrow opening so that you're almost enfolded, you know, just a narrow window that you can get in through in the front. Mm-hmm. They vary enormously. People can see some of them on my website.
Nice. They're ceremonial. I could see somebody being ordained or or anointed or kinged in a chair like that.
The first set of five I ever made was called Conversation Circle for the obvious reason that it was in a public park. So people would sit in them and talk to each other.
That's on your website.
Yeah. Just sit down and talk.
So you have an instinctual knowledge of how big the opening is, depends on the wood, and you do that just freehand with the chainsaw.
With the chainsaw,
golly.
Yeah.
No pressure there. Huh. So then you trim it up, you finish it up, you glaze it, or you put a covering on it?
Yeah. If the piece is for outside, I choose a wood that will last outside. And if it's for indoors, you can pretty much use any wood. But I coat them with Danish oil, whether they're for outside or inside. I use Danish oil. It's a great preservative.
Mm-hmm. And they last a long time that way?
Well, if you pick the right wood outdoors, they're like a redwood, for instance, from California. That will last outside for hundreds of years.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your talk that you gave at the Figgy, you mentioned this wonderful experience that you had when all the different partitions of Ireland and England were talking and trying to come to some understanding. Do you want to talk about that? It was a gift of a bowl, I believe.
Yeah. It was interesting that, as you know, Ireland was ruled by the British for 800 years. And there was a battle in 1690 called the Battle of the Boyne. And it was the battle where the final Irish resistance was overcome. And Ireland in its northeastern quadrant was settled by Scottish and north of England Protestant people. That was deliberately done by the British to create a counterbalance to the native Irish. And it's been a problem ever since because you've two cultures living on the same island.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Battle of the Boyne is celebrated ever since by the Protestants of Northern Ireland. You know, they march every 12th of July. They have
the
Orange Order and this kind of thing. So when the Battle of the Boyne was fought, there was a small walnut tree growing right in the middle of the battlefield. It was probably about 30 or 40 years old at the time of the battle. And the roots would have been watered with the blood of people who were killed in the battle. It was literally right in the middle of the killing field on the Battle of the Boyne site. Now, this tree grew to be 7 feet in diameter at the base. And finally, it fell over about 10 years ago. And I was commissioned to make a number of vessels. And one of them was put aside for a special purpose. And during the Irish peace talks, the Prime Minister of Ireland, Bertie Ahern, at a crucial time when the talks were not going that well, he walked over to the leader of the Loyalists of Northern Ireland, a man called Ian Paisley, and he handed him this bowl that I had made from the walnut from the Battle of the Boyne site. And it completely changed the whole tenure of the talks because Mr. Paisley suddenly realised that the Irish government were not trying to put his tradition into second place. They were in effect, by giving him the bowl, they were saying, your tradition is just as important as ours. Here's proof. And he reached out his hand and he shook our Prime Minister's hand for the very first time ever. And he said, called for a microphone and made a little speech in which he said that he hoped that a deal could be done and that something that would be to the benefit of all the people of Ireland. And they went on with the talks and they came up with a final settlement after 800 years.
Marvellous, marvellous. And this tree, which had been in a battle, and so the blood had nourished the tree.
Exactly.
And so the piece that you gave him had the blood of both sides in it.
Exactly.
Gosh, what a fabulous story.
Yeah.
Well, what, did you do anything else with the wood? Was there any wood left over?
Well, I made a number of pieces, and they were very careful. They only gave me enough wood to make a certain number of pieces. I remember that the Battle of the Boyne is fairly well known in Europe. And so a good few years ago, there was a conference of battlefield supervisors, and the person who supervises Gettysburg and, you know, what was the one up in New York, famous battle there? I forget. But anyway, Waterloo, all of those battlefields, they all came together to Ireland to a conference, and they all got one of my little vessels made from this walnut. But the one that was really important was the one that helped the peace process. That was definitely...
That's marvellous. That's marvellous.
Yeah.
What a great story. You, in a sense, were partially the reason that happened.
Well, I...
Or were you placed there?
If there was... if that bowl hadn't been presented, would the talks have collapsed? One of the reporters who was there, a very well-known international reporter, has told me that he thought the talks were going to collapse, and that the bowl being presented just changed everything.
Hmm.
And that means that there are people walking around now who would have been dead, you know, killed in the conflict, only for that bowl was presented. So it's kind of important.
Marvellous, marvellous story. Gosh.
Any Turner could have made the bowl, by the way. I didn't know where the bowl was going when I made it. But I was just happened to be the one that made that bowl.
Oof. God, I don't know what to say. I think that's just a terrific story.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, you wonder about, you know, God putting me into a wood-turning situation, you know. He must have looked down the laneway of history and saw this coming and said, oh.
And you who left school when you were 14,
yeah,
but who kept on reading, I have something in mind for you. Very interesting. Liam, what a interesting life you've, and you were managing to survive and prosper at your art?
Survive, yes. Prosper, that's doubtful. I'm finding it tough. I think all artists are at the moment. It's tough enough.
Mm-hmm.
But... I must say that one of the best things I ever did was coming to the Figgy and doing this project. It's opened up huge possibilities for other museums to do the same thing.
Oh.
Because we've proved it can be done with a minimum of bother and effort. And so I'm expecting that it will happen again in this country.
Oh, that's excellent. And you have proof and your experience here at the Figgy. So you had like a museum show, as it were. Oh, that's marvelous. What do you have in mind to do now? Are you going to go back to Ireland after tomorrow?
Yeah. It's just basically back to my home in Ireland. And then next spring, I'll be hopefully working on some commissions over in this country again. And then in the fall of next year, I'm doing a circuit of teaching again in this country. I'll be back in Aramont in Tennessee in the School of Arts and Crafts. And doing workshops right across the nation.
That's marvelous. And this will all be on your website? Do you have your schedule up there?
Sometimes I put my schedule up there. I'm kind of bad at keeping my website up to date.
You've got to hire a teenager. They know how to do that kind of stuff. There's got to be somebody around you who knows.
You have a son-in-law who's very good at that sort of thing.
Yeah. Just ask him. Give him some salad bowls or something as a help. Gosh, this is just marvelous. How do you teach? How do you do the classic talk, demonstrate, and then let them go? Is that how you work?
There's two ways. One is to just demonstrate, and usually there's a couple of TV cameras and, you know, monitors showing what you do. That you can teach a large number doing it that way. But I also do hands-on workshops where you might have eight people, each with their own lathe, and then you just do one project in the day and you try to teach them. My whole thing is to stretch their technical ability. That's my chief goal with people. I'm not teaching them how to design. You know, they can come up with their own designs. They have a lot of good design teachers over here. My thing is technique, skill. Stretch your abilities so you can do whatever you want to do.
Vision. Where does the vision come in?
You mean teaching other people how to have vision?
Mm-hmm.
You can't. I think that it's an innate thing that people have, and they can either tap into it or they can't. And I think almost anybody can learn how to tap into it, but they've got to be open-minded. That's the whole secret. I've noticed that some people are almost like, they almost brag about, you know, how conservative they are, how close-minded they are, but they never grow as people. I think you've got to be open to whatever. I read a lot still to this day. I look at other crafts. I look at nature, you know, the shape of a nut, you know, something like an acorn when it bursts open, you know, there's flower pods, you know, there's all kinds of shapes all around you that would inspire you.
Do you take photographs of them or do you draw them? How do you record them?
I let things soak into my brain and then let them just come out.
Mm-hmm.
I had to learn how to draw quite recently, you know, when I started doing commissions and people wanted to know you're going to make something for me, what does it look like? I had to learn how to draw. And so I do travel now with a sketchbook. And, I have to learn by doing, basically.
You're learning how to read music.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Liam O'Neill has been with us, L-I-A-M O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L. .com. You can see his work. His work will be in the River Center. It was really marvelous over the last month or so watching your piece progress from nothing to something and then to be inside. And I actually got to sit in it. And it was just a marvelous feeling to feel enclosed and contained and yet uplifted by this ancient piece of wood that was in the park in Davenport for years and years and years. Best of luck, Liam. Thank you very much. Last question. What advice do you have for young artists? What can you say?
Keep an open mind and keep your eyes open. And above all, don't ever get to the point where you think you know it all. Listen to what everyone says, because even somebody who knows nothing about art can say something sometimes that will teach you something.
Very well said. Look, it's a chair. Yes, very, very good. Liam, thank you very much. Thank you for coming up. I know you have to get back. That's it for us today on Art Talks. Many thanks to our guests. Many thanks to our audio engineer, that maestro of sound, Dave Garner. As always, I'm Bruce Carter. Until next week, have a great night and a fine tomorrow. See you soon, Laura.
Support for Art Talks comes from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com.